Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, December 16th, 2010, going right into the show. And just a second, I have to make an adjustment here. Okay, that looks a little better. Tonight I'm going to be talking a little bit about history, and interestingly enough, over this past week, I have come across some different articles in different locations, and I just always have to muse at how the standard science folks continue to come up with excuses, you might call it that, for what shouldn't be happening but really is. And of course they always have to try and find an excuse for the situation of, for example, finding historical evidence, let's put it that way, of the human race, of human beings, of archaeological finds, for example. And I'm going to go through a couple articles that I found this past week in totally different places. I happened to be sitting in a dentist's office and picked up a National Geographic and looking at some of the, this was an older article on the origin of foods, but it had an article that talked about the Sahara Desert and how the Sahara Desert once was a very vital plant-filled location on Earth. But then it comes to the conclusion that this was due to a wobble in the Earth's axis that helped shift the seasonal rains northward. And it's unbelievable, because there are other parts of the Earth in which there are it's the same situation. The plant life grows well, it rains, so there's no real reason for the plant life or the rain to have changed there, but all of a sudden we see the Sahara Desert changing. But then they also put a date on this of about 8,000 years ago. So about 8,000 years ago, all of a sudden the Sahara Desert decides to jump up and dry out, so to speak. This is truly amazing. And then I'm looking at another article, and they're talking about the lost civilizations in the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, and they're now finding remains of human beings deep beneath the ocean there. And all of a sudden, this happens to be, about 8,000 years ago. A number of weeks ago, probably a couple months ago now, I talked about the Scablands of Oregon and how geologists had come to the conclusion that these Scablands around Oregon all formed at one time about 8,000 years ago. So they keep coming up with this date. And historical dating is kind of difficult. But the point is that all around the world at about 8,000 years ago, and maybe it was sooner than that, maybe it was more recent, maybe it was a little farther back in history. It's hard to say, because I don't really trust the dating of standard science. But the point is that no matter how hard they try, every time they turn around, something happened major on Earth around 8,000 years ago. Or within that time frame. It could have been 4,000 years ago. There could have been multiple events. But at any rate, the point is that standard science then has to come along, and as in with the National Geographic article, they claim that it was a wobble in the Earth's axis. Well, let me see. Isn't the Earth wobbling now? Why isn't how come this all of a sudden made this big change 8,000 years ago? But magically, 8,000 years ago, this special wobble in the Earth's axis cause the Sahara Desert to dry up and the rains to move northward. Just bizarre reasoning. Now, in the article that I found, and this was out of Live Science, a magazine, so give credit where that is, but they also talk about the Persian Gulf and a land area about the size of Great Britain, it says, which all of a sudden sunk under the ocean about 8,000 years ago. Well, gee, that's about the same time that a big piece of land in the South China Sea dropped under the ocean, and that's where I firmly believe the lost continent of Atlantis lies. But the point is that scientists are finding the remnants of animal life and man and tools, etc., very advanced pottery, this kind of remnants being found in the Persian Gulf, many of them under right around the coastline and then going into the sea with the roads going into the sea, etc. So the point is that all over the world, standard science is coming up, and in every case, they have to find a different reason. Now, the reason in the Persian Gulf seems to be a bit different than the reason in National Geographic magazine. One is that the Earth had this amazing wobble in the Earth's axis, and you have to wonder, well, why wasn't that there before? Why did it do it 8,000 years ago? One can also do a very interesting calculation showing that you take the periodic volcanoes of the world, and these are known to go off every so often, so many hundreds of years, some of them as few as 75 years, but they're cyclic. They go off, and then they kind of recede, and then they go off again, and then the pressure recedes. So it's kind of a pulsing, so to speak, but it's on somewhat of a regularity, a time scale regularity. Well, anyway, if you take all of the volcanoes that are active and have regularity, and you take those back in time, some might be a couple hundred years, might be 75 years, and you're looking for what might be called the lowest common denominator. In other words, where did all of those cycle times, where did they all cycle back to where they all hit at the same time? And gee, that's around, it's about 4,500 years ago. So something major happened back then. Something that caused all the volcanoes in the world to go off and set them off on this periodic cycle. All of these things lend to the fact that something happened on Earth, and not just in the Persian Gulf, not just the Sahara Desert, not just the Scablands of Oregon, not just all of these other places. A few weeks ago I talked about the coral reefs that were shifted into non-tropical regions. And these are the topic that I started with, the actual discovery that I started with, was a number of islands that are off of Thailand. They're above water, they contain a great deal of coral, and they are in fact remnants of a recent, you might say, disaster where they were thrust up out of the water. Here we have the Persian Gulf, an area the size of Britain, dropped down under the ocean, and off of Thailand those islands were thrown up. Well, gee, all of this stuff happening at about the same time, and in every case standard science has to quick send their scientists in there to make sure that nobody puts two and two together and figures out that isn't this strange that all over the world all of these things seem to happen at the same time. And the condition was about the same. The animal life, in terms of the mass extinction that we know happened back then, all of that about the same time. Here we have a mass extinction, a known mass extinction on Earth. No explanation for it. Well, it's just that, things got a little tough on Earth at that time. And it just happens to be at about the same time that volcanoes were going off all over. That things, that locations that used to be vast glacier areas turned to water. Gee, but on each one, we have a different or some kind of standard explanation for what happened back then. So anyway, I just wanted to comment because I thought it was comical as I went about my week this past week that in a number of different places, totally unrelated, there were stories still coming out of Standard Science or Standard magazines. And you have to understand that the Standard magazines all cater to this one theme, that all of these things on Earth just happen to happen by themselves, a wobble in the Earth's axis. The ocean in Persia just inundated this area for no reason at all. The Scablands in Oregon, they say there was an ice dam that all of a sudden broke. But gee, there was a big glacier behind it, not a pool of water. So how did that glacier melt all of a sudden in a couple days and form enough water to wash that whole western area of Oregon overnight? There's another wash area that's similar. It comes out beginning at the Green River, Utah area up in Utah and up into Colorado. It stretches up into the southwestern Colorado. But it washes all the way through New Mexico, all the way to the ocean. And when you see this from the air, by the way, which you can see, I have a CD on my webpage with 110 aerial photos of the American Southwest. You can see that big wash area going all the way up to the Colorado Rocky Mountains. And it's taken from over New Mexico from an altitude of about 45,000 feet on an extremely clear day. Those pictures I took myself. But an excellent, excellent picture of this wash area in New Mexico once again in that same time. And isn't it interesting that that wash area begins in the Green River, Utah area, where the cave petroglyphs, the drawings that are on the cave walls around Green River, are depicting comets, very large comets. And that one of those petroglyphs I have on the cover of my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, the first book in the series. So isn't that interesting that those pictures are there drawn by the ancients, and what are they depicting? A big comet with a big squiggly spike on it. Now, I'm going to fast forward to this past week. There was a discovery posted on all over the internet, so this came in from all over, but an asteroid called Sheila 596. I believe that's the name. Let me just double check that in case you, Sheila, S-C-H-E-I-L-A. So the asteroid name is 596 Sheila, and it's a main belt asteroid, was discovered about 100 years ago, and has been well known, well observed, and its orbit is well known. Well, gee, just this last week, at the same time, we were having this massive snowstorm across the United States as the temperatures in England and Northern Europe were plummeting, and we had basically almost a worldwide cold snap throughout the Northern Hemisphere. Isn't it interesting that we had Venus coming around on its inferior conjunction? And also, isn't it interesting that this lined up with Sheila, with the asteroid? But coincident with this, we also had the solar flare. Now, these booming solar flares came out and basically caused the snowstorms that we had over the past week. Last Saturday, I happened to enjoy... Not really. I went out unwittingly and tried to drive in this snowstorm in Minnesota. It was unbelievable. I've been a resident, I've been through very harsh, severe winter weather all my life. I've lived in the tropics also, but spent a good deal of time, including my youth and a lot of time growing up, there was one winter I spent up in central Ontario. Living outside, literally living outside. So in the course of my life, my short life on this planet, I've seen a lot of severe winter weather, but this one held the cake Well, it wasn't the most severe, because I was also here for the 1991 Halloween blizzard, the biggest storm in history in the state of Minnesota. So that's saying a lot. That goes way back. And also, that was one of the storms, the October 31st Halloween blizzard of 1991, which, by the way, covered many, many states. That was the first of the three storms to make up what is now known as the perfect storm. Remember that three hurricanes joined forces to create the mega storm in the North Atlantic, which is now called the perfect storm. And there was a movie made about that with 100-foot waves, and of course there was a boat out there, which was the center part of the movie, and I believe the boat was lost at sea. But that shows the boat trying to ride up these 100-foot, just mammoth seawalls with hurricane-force winds out in the North Atlantic. And when one asks the question to standard science, well, aren't hurricanes formed in warm water? And you see this, the biggest hurricane in history in the North Atlantic in the end days of October, in frigid cold water. Where's the warm water that's fueling it? Well, obviously, standard science is just ridiculous. It's one of the most ridiculous concepts in the world, that hurricanes are formed by warm water. But that's explained more in my weather book. But there again, if they admitted to the real source of power of hurricanes, or the perfect storm, or the weather system that moved through the Midwest and most of the United States a couple weeks ago, they would have to admit that space is electrically active. And if they did, then the absolute first thing that would have to be asked by all people is, well, if it's electrical out there, why don't we grab a hold of a piece of that? And can we use this on a continual basis for free energy? And I'm not talking about putting a box on a table that all of a sudden magically spits out energy. No. This is energy that comes from the sun. It's very well explainable when you look at the research that I've done, that the storms, these powerful storms, like the one that just moved through the Midwest this past week, the 11th most powerful storm in history, that in terms of the United States, in terms of Minnesota, and that's saying a lot, the 11th most powerful storm in history, it was created by a solar flare. We saw the solar flares coming. There were two of them, and basically went by the side of Earth. But just guess what? When I was talking about asteroid Sheila, this past week, as that solar flare went out, as it caused this tremendous weather on Earth, as we also had the inferior conjunction of Venus coming around on December the 13th, was the actual the inferior conjunction of Venus was a little bit before that, so that means it was already well connected into the outer solar system. But that's about the time it connected electrically with asteroid Sheila, that's about halfway out from Earth, about halfway to the distance of Jupiter. So there was this electrical connection across the solar system, and it's rather comical, once again, to see all the standard explanations. You go to spaceweather.com, and they show the picture of Sheila, the asteroid, which all of a sudden now magically has a comet tail. There was never any comet tail associated with it before, and they're kicking around the bush trying to pretend that it's really not a comet tail, but it's a comet tail. So isn't that interesting? So what does the standard science misinformation for the tier two people that run spaceweather.com, this is good science. So what's their good science? It says that, well, there's two explanations out there. First, it was hit by another asteroid. Wow. Okay, so here's an asteroid flying around out in the middle of almost nowhere vacuum space, and it's hit by an asteroid. And that's what you would expect from standard science, because that's their explanation for everything. If it's like I call it the Chicken Little explanation of NASA. It's falling, it hit me on the head. That's the NASA explanation for everything. An asteroid hit it. And you can't prove it or disprove it. You can't show that that's what caused anything, but that's what they pull out of the hat to try and pawn off to the public, the garbage science that they try and pawn off to the public. And then the second explanation is that there was mysteriously a small patch of ice on the this asteroid that all of a sudden became exposed for some reason. So after millions and millions of years of being an asteroid, all of a sudden, 2 weeks ago, it exposes this surface ice and becomes a comet. Well, of course, those are both absolutely ridiculous explanations, because if there were that type of water or ice near the surface of the asteroid, then it would have basically gone away a long time ago. There's a thing called vapor pressure in outer space. And if you don't have pressure on an object, you need a number of things to maintain ice, for example. And one of them is you need some vapor pressure. You need some vapor pressure around it, but the temperature around it has to be cold also. If you have warm air around an icy object, especially a piece of ice, and then it will melt. But if you don't have any pressure around that ice, it will vaporize. It'll just simply turn to vapor, especially given the average temperature of ice. It's simply not going to last very long in outer space. Certainly not 4 billion years, as they're trying to claim, but they can just do this hand-waving and say the tail of asteroid 596 Sheila was caused by either an asteroid hitting it or the exposure of some kind of subsurface water, and all of a sudden it became a comet tail. But if you look at what really is going on in outer space, that comets are electrical in nature, that they are connected electrically with the rest of the solar system, and you see that Venus came around, all of a sudden it went through its inferior conjunction with Earth a number of days earlier, and then on December 13th hooked up with an electrical alignment out to the asteroid, and the asteroid sparks up, starts to discharge the solar capacitor, and is visibly a comet. That is what's going on. So that is interesting, because it happened at exactly the same time as the major winter storms were rolling across the United States. Standard science does not connect the dots. It doesn't even connect two dots. In fact, they're required to refrain from connecting dots. In standard science, if someone's a comet scientist, they can't talk about planets, because that's over there. That's the planet guys. If somebody talks about planets, they can't talk about geology or why mountains formed or why the scablands of Oregon formed 8,000 years ago on Earth. They can't talk about it because they're a planet person. It always amazed me when I was out at Cornell in 1979 to 1981, and I was talking to the space scientists there in the space science department, and I went in to talk to one of the comet scientists, and I said, you know, there's a relationship between planets and comets, and I mentioned the relationship that comets are actually attracting material and becoming planets. And as soon as you said the word planet, then that astronomer, that space scientist who dealt with comets, would say, oh, well, that's the arena of so-and-so. He deals with planets. And you'd go talk to the planet guy and say, well, you know, planets exhibit many cometary properties. They have these long ion tails, which you call a magnetic tail. Very much looks like a comet tail, but you call it a magnetic tail. Whatever. But then look at all the other properties that Earth has and all the planets have that look like comets. Oh, comets, you have to go talk to this guy. He's the comet specialist. They cannot cross those barriers, those intellectual barriers. And that's what keeps standard science in a fixed mode. That's why it can never change, because nobody can ever think outside of their little box, and they certainly don't want to. Because if they criticize the comet guys, then they could become, they would basically get in trouble, let's put it that way, and possibly lose their position. And nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to upset the apple cart. And so at any rate, the whole point is here, here we look at lost civilizations. We look at civilizations that went under the ocean. Some that were, some areas of land that were thrust up at about the same time. We look at vast areas around the world, all of these things happening at about the same time. We look at the fact that along the western coast of Peru, along the Pacific Ocean, cities have been found with millions of people, a population of millions of people, that just simply disappeared. And these cities existed probably before the Egyptian pyramids were ever built. And so how did man originate in this cradle of civilization? And all of a sudden through Mesopotamia and the Persian area, branch out and become all of these various types of human beings, the various different groupings of human beings. How did this one population group move out, and within a few short thousand years, of which we have pretty much the history for most of it, we know what people looked like over these past few thousands of years. They didn't change that much. They still looked like people. They might have been a little smaller, but the point is that the human race has not changed that much. The populations of Africa or the populations of India or China, if you go back and you look at their history that goes back thousands of years, they didn't come from some original mutant being that kind of looked like all of the other ones. It's kind of like looking for the Big Bang in astrophysics. If you go back in time, then everything should migrate back to a very similar condition, and it really is not true. That's not the way the universe is. It's not viewed that way. It's not seen that way. But the point is that if, as you go back in time, the Chinese should look a lot different than they look today. Well, they don't. In all of the historic representations that we see of the Chinese, they look the same. The same with countries near them, Tibet, India. Those people look the same as you go back through history. And so these civilizations that supposedly grew out of one seed population of humans back in the cradle of civilization in Mesopotamia, a number of, you know, within 10,000 years ago, you find that that's absolutely ridiculous. How could all of the different races in Africa or the small, short people in South America, how could all of these races possibly come from one seed location? And the answer is that they didn't. That those populations developed separately over who knows what time frame, 100,000 years possibly, and finally got to the point where they are, where they were when the great discovery sailing ventures went out, when Magellan went out, when Vasco da Gama, when Columbus, in that time frame. When those groups finally went out and started rediscovering the world, they found them pretty much in the state that we see them today. But if you go way back in history, on any of those lines, like I say, China or India or the South American lines or the Central American lines, they look pretty much the same thousands of years ago as they did when they were first discovered. And if they're still in existence today, they still look the same, very similar. So that just tells you that within the 7 to 10,000 year time frame, that there's just not enough time for the human races that you see all around the world, all the different ones, for them to evolve out of one cradle of civilization. It's another story that just absolutely makes absolutely no sense. But it's taught, and it's here it is, National Geographic. Here it is, New Science Magazine. I can't believe these people can sleep at night. I can't believe that they somehow get PhDs and think that they know something. This is just absolutely absurd, which brings me up to somewhat the point of this show. And as we're culminating the year 2010, the year that Stanley Kubrick projected would be the year that the human race was going out to the planet Jupiter in a vast space station looking for remnants of alien life, etc. Which, of course, we're nowhere near that, even though we spent enough money. And if we would have taken the effort put into military hardware and efforts fighting pointless wars all over the years to maintain the bankers and their tax and banking system, this human race would be so far advanced. We would be using space electricity. We would be living in a life where we didn't have to work 40 hours a week, 51 weeks a year, just to pay for interest on the loan for a house, which is overinflated price-wise, and a car, which is very much overinflated, and for energy to drive back and forth to work so that we can pay for interest. Absolutely ridiculous. But how could a group of people running the world maintain all of us out here, me included? I mean, I have to do certain things to maintain and live in this modern society. And how could the people in charge of the banking and the money and the wars and the science, who own the science and feed out and assure that the bad science is what you hear, how could they maintain control? And the answer is that once they get the system set up, then people are simply locked in there, and it takes a big effort to leave, to simply get away. And oddly enough, there's all kinds of roadblocks that prevent you from leaving and just going away and having a happy life. There was a guy, I remember, in Wisconsin, I believe it was, and he lived on his farm. He didn't go away, and he says, "I don't use any of the infrastructure of the county. I don't do anything that would require its use. I don't ask for anything. I just want to live on my farm and be left alone." Well, eventually, of course, they came in and kicked him off his property because he wasn't allowed, literally was not allowed, and the people running the county were very angry because how could anybody think that they didn't need the county? And so they basically came in and through legalized mechanisms threw the guy off his land and, you know, tossed him off, basically said, "Go, you're out of here." So, at any rate, the point is that I watched a movie. This brings up another point. I watched a movie this past week, and you can watch it also. It's a movie for Christmas that's out there. It's called The Nativity, and I believe it was made in Italy. It's made in English, but it has subtitles also in, I think, a few other languages. But anyway, it's called Nativity, The Nativity. And it's the story of the birth of Christ, and it kind of goes through. Amazing that the three kings, when they looked at the star, it had day after day after day the alignment of planets as the star. So they managed to get that in there. This, you know, the misinformation that gets put into movies is just incredible. But they had to have that planetary alignment concept in there for the Christmas star. And I've gone through this over and over again, but it's very funny that they do show that the kings had to take weeks and months, literally, to travel from where they were in the east across the desert to Bethlehem, where the nativity took place. But they claim that it's due to this planetary alignment, and they keep showing these three bright stars up in the sky. Well, planetary alignments don't work that way. They only last a couple hours, and it's just it's amazing how they weave this into the story. But then the other point, the real point that I wanted to make about this movie, is that a theme that is very consistent throughout the movie is the military, the Roman military that's out in this region of the world at the time, and how the military puppet governors rule with an iron fist. They show that Herod killed all of the firstborns males because he found out that the new Messiah, the leader that would be coming, was a baby. He was originally looking for an adult, so that he was killing all kinds of people who were outspoken and adults. And then all of a sudden he realized that the three kings told him that that they were looking for a baby, a newborn baby, and that was the king, and it was a male. And so anyway, Herod sent out a decree to have all of the firstborn babies, males of the country, killed, because they knew that they were in that country. Of course, that's the story of the nativity and the flight into Egypt, etc. But the interesting part is the theme of militarism, the taxation, the overtaxation of the public, down to the point where they simply can't exist anymore, and the pompous nature of the leaders who wanted golden walls and every finery for their castles and locations for their dwellings and castles, etc. They would have every possible amenity at the expense of the common person who was just taxed literally to, and then after being taxed, some of their people were drawn away. The women hauled off in one direction and the young men hauled off in another direction to be slaves, basically for the wealthy. But the same issue with taxation, the poor people living on a survival mode with very little money and the inability, and then the militarism, which dominates the entire theme to support the aggressive nature of the leaders. They had to go out and conquer foreign lands to better their lot in life and at the expense of the poor people. Let's go back to the weather systems that moved through the Midwest and the entire country this past week. We actually had two waves of storms and very noticeably solar conditions that were moving by Earth at the time, causing these storms. So isn't it amazing that as this is happening, global warming legislation is being pushed through Congress? It was interesting to see some of the blogs, and people clearly know that, just the average person on the street clearly knows that there's no possible way that global warming could possibly be a reality. And some of them don't know why, but the stark reality is that, sure, we warmed up for a number of years, but that was due to the solar conditions. Now solar conditions are diminishing, and all of a sudden, so is the heat that's coming to Earth. And we are having some very, I would call it, scary situations. You look at England, you look at Northern Europe. I just got a report in, I think it was yesterday, Germany completely shut down this past week due to snow and cold. Germany is a country that's prepared, allegedly, and they have mountains. Germany has tremendous history of dealing with cold weather. So all of a sudden, here we are in 2010, and the worst winter in memorable history coming along, shutting down the entire country of Germany. England completely shut down. As I mentioned, I believe last week, that when you see a satellite photo of England, they had to make a dotted line around where the coastline would be so you could actually see the island, because from the satellite photo, all you would see was ice, and this ice extends, ice and with snow cap, and in a lot of places the ice extends out over the ocean, something that's really unheard of, where for hundreds of years England was bathed by the warm ocean currents coming up from the Gulf of Mexico and from the Caribbean region, and these heat systems would drive that warm water, which would ride up on the surface, all the way to England and all the way actually up to Denmark and the northern European countries. But this year that is not happening. And those people are experiencing the equivalent of Moscow weather. If you can imagine a Moscow winter in England. And that's what's happening. The other part of that story, of course, is that nobody is talking about it. This is not something that you're going to see in mainstream media. They're more worried about the editor of WikiLeaks, if he had a date or not. This is the kind of news you get, the meaningless news that covers the pages of news stories, because if it were known or if well advertised on a daily basis, as it should be, that Germany, that the major European countries, that England and related countries in Northern Europe, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, etc., that those countries are basically unable to cope. If you look even in the United States, I got some articles from somewhat eastern central United States, or Ohio having severe weather, people not able to cope with it, many houses burning down. The reason they're burning down is people are not prepared. They're trying to burn a very hot wood fire or a wood stove, or maybe in some cases an improperly installed wood stove, to heat their houses that are poorly built for a severe winter. They're built for somewhat of a moderate winter, but they're not built as in the northern states like Detroit or Minneapolis, especially Minneapolis or Wisconsin or North Dakota, where you pretty much can expect severe weather during the winter. Ohio is a stage warmer, and should not be that big a problem. But they're having severe weather there all the way down. The jet stream is dragging that cold all the way down into Florida. And so remember last year we had a similar situation. So one has to ask the question, is there global warming? And of course people say, well, what we said was climate change. No, no. What they said was climate change after they realized that global warming, the greenhouse effect, and the greenhouse gas myth was propagated. They couldn't stop it. So now they're saying that actually all this severe weather was one of the results of global warming, that all of a sudden global warming should cause sub-zero weather, high winds, and snow. That would be caused by global warming, according to global warming theorists. Absolutely ridiculous. So the state of science today, the state of explanations of the history of man, the state of basically just about anything you would study in college or at the university level today is in a state of total misinformation. That's about the best thing you can say. Some of the pure sciences like mathematics or like say basic physics or basic chemistry, basic biology, a lot of this is well known. The experiments have been done, they're repeatable, and if you do those experiments today, they'll be the same as they were 30 years ago. So there's not a lot of confusion in those areas. But when you talk about the science of how the solar system formed, interpretive science, in other words, subjective science. That's the big difference. What's the difference between objective science and subjective science? Objective science is verifiable by experiment. Those experiments are repeatable and with third-party verification. What's subjective science? That's when data comes in and somebody goes, well, I think this is from the early solar system about a billion years after the Earth started, and they have no more idea of what they're talking about than the man in the moon. But they got a PhD, they can write this in a paper, they can get it published, and therefore it's supposedly right. And that's unfortunately what's been going on for a long time. It'd be interesting to actually go in to some of the reference trees and see how much real valuable information would be in those volumes and volumes of journals that fill the libraries of universities across the country. I would venture to say that in some categories, say cometary science, 99% of everything that is there is absolutely wrong and useless. On the history of man, probably just about everything is wrong and useless that you would find in a university. And as I've said before, that's because it does not include the major event or events that formed the earth, that formed civilizations, that weeded out the animal populations. So at any rate, now let me go through once again, I kind of skimmed over this. Now asteroid 596 Sheila came around behind Earth. It's a main belt asteroid, and let me just explain the sequence of events as they happened that would explain why this asteroid all of a sudden formed a comet tail. Okay, so here's the sequence of events. Asteroid 596 Sheila is coming around in its orbit around behind Earth. Earth is catching up to it because we're in a lower orbit. We're closer to the sun. So the situation, let me just explain this. On December 13th, when I took a snapshot of the position of these planets, etc., in outer space, the Earth is still moving up somewhat behind the direct alignment. This is all relative to an alignment with the sun. And so, take a line, a dotted line between the comet, now the comet, or previously the asteroid 596 Sheila. Take a direct line between that asteroid and the sun. Relative to that line, Earth is coming up from behind. And on December 13th, it has a bit of a way to go. However, Venus comes around, which had just been in a inferior conjunction with Earth a number of days earlier. That means that Venus and Earth aligned electrically with the sun and did an electrical exchange, an electrical connection. And of course, that's part of that weather system, the driving mechanism also. But the point is that Venus now leaves that electrical alignment with Earth. It starts pulling ahead in its orbit because it's in a lower orbit than Earth. It goes around the sun in a shorter period of time than Earth does. So it starts speeding ahead relative to this sun-Earth line and starts to make contact with the asteroid 596 Sheila on around December 13th, and that's when the flaring started. So you see these sequence of events. If you know what to look for, it's easy. It's easy to understand what actually happened and why that asteroid flared up and formed a comet tail. So just as a review, once again, Venus came around. First, the Venus and Earth had a conjunction, basically an alignment, electrical alignment, with the sun. That causes Earth to have severe weather. That causes Venus to leave that electrical conjunction with a long extended comet tail, basically of its own, an electrical connection with the sun, but much more extended than normal, allowing it to reach out. And now all of a sudden there's a solar flare, not just a solar flare, but a big solar flare that comes blasting out into this area, causing Venus to discharge more, causing the asteroid to sit in that same discharge area, and lo and behold, now Venus and the asteroid are electrically connected, and this is enough to cause sufficient electrical currents to pass by the asteroid to kick it off, to allow it to discharge the solar capacitor and form comet activity. Now, if you were to go to the comet nucleus of asteroid 596 Sheila, you wouldn't find water or some kind of hidden pocket of water on the surface of that celestial object. You would find a hot, dry rock, exactly what all the other asteroids are, the way they are floating around in space, a hot, dry rock with no water on it at all. So, at any rate, but once again, if you look at all of these, if you look at the history of man, if you look at the Persian Gulf with the civilization going under about 7 or 8,000 years ago, And by the way, they also know when that land rose above the ocean. It was about 75,000 years previous to that. So at any rate, the point is that almost, you know, every place you look, you find one glaring result. And that is something is going on in the solar system that is very dynamic. It's not understood by standard science. And it's not talked about. And standard science is this hodgepodge of band-aid theories that the earth wobbled to make the Sahara Desert dry. What a ridiculous concept. But there it is in National Geographic magazine. I'll tell you the page. You can go look for it yourself. Let's see, National Geographic, September 2008 issue. It says, Where Food Begins. That's the cover article. The September 2008 National Geographic, page 131. Look it up. In the very top left-hand side of page 131, it says, a green moment, and it talks about the grasslands on the Sahara Desert. And then all of it says, many factors cause this, including a wobble in Earth's axis helped shift seasonal rains northwards. Where do these people get this? It is so absurd. This is so reaching so far into the rabbit hat. There's no, absolutely no dynamical explanation for why a wobble in the Earth's axis would cause rain to shift northwards. Where does that come from in standard science? Where is the connection? Where is the science? Where are the studies and years of studies that have to be printed to prove that a wobble in the Earth's axis causes rain to move northwards? Why didn't it move southwards? It's so absurd. It's beyond absurd. But there it is, National Geographic. And if it's in National Geographic, then it must be true. It is so absurd. The garbage that is passed off to the public today, and the bottom line is, if the real reason were known for why this happened, that around 8,000 years ago, a giant electrical plasma discharge comet came roaring through the solar system, and not only did electrical damage to Earth and the other planets, but it also did some significant physical damage through gravitational waves. So, excuse me. But according to standard science, a wobble in the Earth's axis caused rain to move northwards 8,000 years ago magically. Wow. I just, some days I feel like my forehead is going to be kind of bashed in flat, kind of that Neanderthal look because of hitting myself in the forehead so many times when I read this garbage that you see everywhere, whether it's the History Channel, National Geographic magazine or TV, whether it's Discover Channel or Discover Magazine. And you look at this and you go, how can these people, teams of scientists, editors, presidents of magazines, how can they all sleep at night and publish this absolute garbage? But that's the state of science. So the point is, there is an explanation for why these things occurred. There's an explanation for why there were mass extinctions within the last 10,000 years. And we could have it happen again. But there again, if people understood the real nature of science, they would go immediately, why am I doing this? Why am I running up and down the road every week? Why as a civilization are we not preparing for food for a long emergency situation? Why aren't we preparing pockets of society that would be successful if an all-out solar system-wide event occurred? Why aren't we putting vast numbers of people into space in space cities, as was suggested in Kubrick's 2010 movie? And also, that's just a common theme It's one of the themes of my recent book, The Diamond Principle, that man has to progress. Man has to pick up the man has to pick up what he's doing, because we only have a certain amount of time on this planet, and it's becoming very short. So anyway, as we move into Christmas, the obvious misinformation regarding the Christmas star is out there. It's in major movies that are being passed off to the public. And, you know, I think, isn't it interesting that most of the movie that I saw, The Nativity, was fairly accurate to historical record, but the one thing that was absolutely woven through this movie and repeated over and over again, so by the time you got done with the movie, there was no mistake that they were trying to promote the idea of a Christmas star being a three-way planetary alignment that lasted for months and months and months, even in spite of the fact that it is absolutely untrue science. There's never going to be a three-way planetary alignment for a long period of time. And that is going to stay there for months and months. That's the point. So you have absolutely bad science mixed into a movie that is somewhat accurate. But as I've always said, you have to have good bait. You have to have some truth to articles or to programs or movies, whatever. You have to have something true in there to draw people in to make them think it's true. But then you weave in the misinformation, because if it were known, first of all, that it was a comet, well then, gee, what's so strange about some little comet? It's just a dirty snowball. What would make it so strange? And so that's what I said before. Well, the Christmas star had to be a comet. It had to have something very strange about it. A comet with a companion would be strange, but a comet with two companions would be extremely strange. And that's what brought me to the conclusion to say that would be one of my top possibilities for the Christmas star, is a comet with two companions, and possibly even a very well-known cycle time for those two companions. At any rate, well, this is Jim McCanny. I'm about running out of time this week. Just remember to go to the webpage, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, and listen to the archives of this show online, and check out the various, there's about 3 gigabytes of information, so that it's enough to keep most people busy for quite a while. And if you're new to this, make sure you allow yourself a lot of time. This is not a topic that you can go and get a couple quick sound bites or an article here or an article there. There's a lot of information. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.